Back in November, a group of climate activists gathered in front of Queen's Park, Ontario's legislative building. They were standing up for Umgenong First Nation, where people are facing a public health crisis due to pollution from an area often called Chemical Valley.
We had evacuation happen in April due to how high benzene levels were, and our community members were sent to the hospital.
Beezy Gray is one of the youth working to spread awareness about the toxic chemicals harming the community and environment. Last April, when a company near Umgenong removed a toxic chemical from their site, the air quality was so bad that about 100 people were advised to evacuate. Gray is leading the call for government action.
We had to have a severe accident to be listened to be heard. So
Umgenong is calling for free, prior, and informed consent on projects that impact their lands, health, and culture. They demand stronger government action to protect their community and the environment.
Today we are listing our demands, and we're hoping that we have the support and solidarity and that we actually see change in Umgenong.
All across Turtle Island, communities like Beezy's are seeing the effects of pollution and climate change, while weather changes like extreme heat or flash floods are some common global impacts. When it comes to the impacts on individual communities, it takes a climate warrior to bring those stories forward and demand action.
This change doesn't happen until community members speak up.
Danse Anine Boujou. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. We are making our way into a new climate change reality. We are looking for hope and solutions. And in many communities, it's Indigenous youth that are leading the charge.
We are very intimately connected to the lands around us, and we are able to see these changes directly and very suddenly when they take place.
Serena Mondesable brings together grassroots action and clean energy infrastructure to preserve her community's culture and ceremonial way of life. And after growing up surrounded by industrial refineries in Sarnia, Ontario, Beezy Gray took the provincial government to court over its climate action and inaction. That fight could prove that a government's failure to protect the environment is a failure to uphold the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
We are basing it on the impacts that climate change has on our charter rights. We are a youth generation trying to challenge climate targets that are set by a different generation in this government system.
And Jordan Burnoff brings youth in her community together to dream up a clean energy future.
Young people just know it. Young people just get it. It is unbiased. It's like not tarnished by all of the economics, by laws, by all of these like concepts or constructs that we make. Like young people just, they just get it.
Today, these young Indigenous climate warriors fight to protect their lands for the next seven generations. On the banks of the Grand River in southern Ontario sits a leader in clean energy. Six Nations has invested heavily in large-scale solar and wind projects, including a massive 77-turbine wind farm on the Niagara Escarpment. Serena Mondesable is proud of her community's work, but when she learned more about the decision-making processes, she realized that youth were rarely included, so she set out to change that. Serena now works to bridge the gap between grassroots work and clean energy infrastructure. She does this through her work as co-chair of the 7th Gen Indigenous Youth Council, a youth-led not-for-profit that empowers Indigenous climate projects. She is also managing director at Sacred Earth Solar, an organization that helps communities take on solar energy projects. And she sits on the board of directors at Student Energy, a global youth-led organization focused on education and empowerment. Serena, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, wow, what an intro. I really appreciate the kind words.
Well, you've certainly done a lot in the couple decades you've been on this planet, I got to say. Where do you come from and what connects you to the land there?
I'm Cuba Wolf Clan from Six Nations of the Grand River, as you've said. And Six Nations is about an hour south of Toronto, southwest. We're the most populous community in the country with around 28,000 members. And we have the largest clean energy portfolio, which is kind of what got me into climate work. But I feel like I've been doing grassroots work since I was around 8 years old. In 06, we had, and many people might know this, the Gunnestado, the protected place, is a large land conflict between our community, as well as the OPP in the province of Ontario, regarding our land rights and the Douglas Creek estates that were going to be built. And I feel like I grew up in the backdrop of a lot of land conflict and understanding what harm was happening, not only to our lands, but to our peoples. And from there, honestly, it's been the community behind me that has really pushed me to take things to the next level, especially when it comes to our lands and understanding our sacred relationship as Haudenosaunee people to our lands. I've been privileged enough to be able to work now for, I think, a decade and a half on certain issues such as youth justice, climate justice, as well as building clean energy futures. And it all comes back to my own people.
Well, that is quite a journey in your work. Can you give me an example of how you've seen or experienced how climate change has impacted or disrupted, you know, your community in that connection?
I think there's a two-phase process when it comes to the impacts that we're actually facing in Six Nations. One being the environmental degradation that is furthering climate change impacts, from housing developments to industry. We have over 20 mega dams on our Grand River, which is actually the largest watershed in all of Ontario. And not only that, we have industry all over on the river as well, such as sewage, manufacturing, a lot of agriculture, mass agriculture. And with all of this being said, it's heavily impacted our lands, our waters, our food. Many of us don't have clean drinking water in Six Nations. We're not on any water lines. We're using well systems that are then impacted through groundwater contamination. But then with all of these happening alongside each other, we've now seen major climate impacts along our territory. And right now it's December 1st, we don't have any snow, which we did back in the day. And we've seen these changes and these fluctuations are actually impacting our ceremonial cycles. So we have like maple tree ceremonies. And last year, there wasn't a deep enough freeze for the maple trees in the ground for us to be able to tap our maple trees and therefore to do ceremony. Now, it's not just the climate impacts that are happening, but also the cultural and ceremonial impacts that will be a product of the environmental degradation and climate change we are currently seeing. We are very intimately connected to the lands around us, and we are able to see these changes directly and very suddenly when they take place.
That is a lot to deal with, not just as a young person, but as a community, to have to try and to counter that. What are some of the things that Six Nations has done to, you know, counter some of these climate changes?
Yeah, and so this is where I think it gets interesting, and what has Six Nations really, really done? And I think for a community as large as mine, I don't think we're actually doing enough. I think a lot of the solutions beyond what the grassroots and what our traditional governance are doing are very business oriented and really focus on economic development, which obviously we need, but it has to come back to the roots of why we're doing this. And it's because we can't be Haudenosaunee without our lands and our territories and our culture.
Is it just, I'm understanding that you don't feel that the Six Nations is doing enough on the front line with the grassroots? Is there things that they're doing? You mentioned some economic reasons that they're doing it, but are those things helping, and what are those things?
When it comes to Six Nations and the Development Corporation, they are producing over 1,600 megawatts of clean energy. And with that being said, there is this major reduction of greenhouse gas emissions coming from the projects that the Development Corporation are creating. And this does benefit us globally, nationally. But then I think I come back to my community and we're still not having our traditional foods or seeds. We're still trying to protect our seeds. We don't have clean drinking water. And so as much as these major projects are providing this global reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, when I think of a just transition, it's not just the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. It's healthy, sovereign nations for elders and youth leading. And it's the ability to be able to be on our lands and to drink our water and to eat our country foods, which is still not happening. I think we just are working in silos right now when it comes to Six Nations and not really able to look at this larger vision, which is actually why myself and a colleague of mine are leading a Six Nations climate action strategy plan that will be able to bring everything together. So this has really been a big part of trying to bring all of this work that's happening in silos together under one comprehensive plan so that we may be able to get up to a place where not only are we combating the reduction of GHG, but we're also protecting our lands in a way that feels good.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you wanted to build bridge between these silos and the things that they're doing already on this level, but you want to do it on the grassroots level and the front line. How do you do that? What are the things that you're doing to build those bridges?
So I think that's been this big thing for the last 10 years of really trying to build the bridges between the grassroots, between clean energy infrastructure. And I'm really happy and lucky to be able to say this, but I feel like I got to a place this year where I actually was able to bring some of these worlds together, especially in our community of Six Nations. And so as a young person myself, I am a managing director at Sacred Earth Solar. We're an Indigenous woman-led grassroots organization that focuses on implementing climate solutions and healing justice in Indigenous communities. And so with that being said, I was able to, since November 2022, able to work on a Sour Springs Longhouse Sustainable Restoration Project. And so the Sour Springs Longhouse is one of the longest remaining longhouses in Six Nations, governed by the Cuga Nation. It houses chiefs, clan mothers, faith keepers, youth, elders, families in this longhouse where we can practice our ceremonial obligations, we can harvest, we even have our funerals there. It really is this all-encompassing space for us as Haudenosaunee. And with the sustainable restoration, a lot of the knowledge that I had taken being trained in Indigenous clean energy through many different orgs, such as Seven Gen, the one I work with, Student Energy, Indigenous Clean Energy, going off and doing my master's, working with different communities, it was time to bring it home. And so with that being said, I decided let's implement a project, a climate infrastructure project in Sour Springs governed by our traditional governance that will help create a healthy and safe and comfortable space for our people. And so with this Sour Springs Sustainable Restoration, it's a three-phased project, one with energy efficient retrofit. So it'll be reducing our overall energy usage in the longhouse by one, building energy conservation, so just using less energy, and two, providing low carbon technologies through energy efficient retrofit. So this can be a heat pump that basically switches your heating to electricity. This can be heat recovery ventilators, which improves indoor air quality. It can be as easily as caulking and weather sealing your door, so you're losing less energy. This is a major thing that I believe is a just transition, and also is the first step to any project you should be doing when it comes to clean energy. Two, which is really exciting because it was just operational 2 weeks ago, is our hybrid solar PV nanogrid system at the Sour Springs Longhouse, which will be providing electricity to all five buildings on the property. And we take a hybrid system, so we're using a battery system, so we can mostly be off grid, but if we need to use extra energy, we can always take some from the grid. The third component, which we're currently working on, is a low carbon seed storage facility. And so coming back to really our teachings and our seeds, which mean everything to us, we'll be having a centralized place that will be able to house Haudenosaunee seeds for all the Haudenosaunee communities. And this has been really exciting because it brings in the knowledge I was learning about low carbon and energy efficient green building, which is a mouthful, but also through our traditional knowledge of our seeds. And so this project it's my love letter to my community. And I think as a young person, I was able to really see this vision through to bring these different worlds together and how we can do things right. And I think that's what I always think as a young person. And I see the clean energy work going on in Six Nations. I see some other work, but I always say, how about we make good things even better? And how about we make them accessible to all of our people?
Yeah. And so you're building this, and what will building this allow your community to then do? Of course, you're going to be storing your seeds there, which are very important to Haudenosaunee people and their connection to the land. And then what, practicing culture, is that what your goal is for this space?
Our goal is for the space is to sustain our ceremonies and our cultures, but also to be energy sovereign and food sovereign. Mm. It comes back to the sovereignty, and we're able to govern ourselves in a sovereign way. We're able to conduct our ceremonies in a sovereign way, but sometimes we're not able to access energy or access food in a sovereign way. And so this really just keeps building our sovereignty so that one day we can be self-sufficient.
Yeah. Why is it important for you that your climate action as a Haudenosaunee youth intersects with, you know, the indigenous knowledge that you've learned and the indigenous knowledge that your people carry and hope to carry forward?
As a Haudenosaunee youth and as a just a young person in general, an indigenous young person, I see this intersection between climate action and indigenous knowledge, because we can't be Haudenosaunee without the lands or the waters. And I was thinking about this, and the Wet'suwet'en Chief Namox came to our community to meet our Confederacy a couple years ago now. And he was talking with one of the chiefs, and he said, "I'm not being radical. I'm not trying to protest. I'm just trying to be Wet'suwet'en." And I think that speaks volumes at the end of the day, is all I'm trying to do is be Haudenosaunee. And by taking climate action, that's the only way that I can be Haudenosaunee, is by protecting our lands and waters, by reducing my energy usage, by using clean energy. I think about even our translation for Yetini Stoa Hunja, which is our mother, she provides for us. And that's how we understand the earth around us, is this maternal, intimate relationship that we have always held and that takes care of us. And I think of the Ohando Garli Wadakwa, the Thanksgiving address. We also say the Ganyohanyo and Kyuga. Morning and night, we are to give thanks and gratitude to everything around us, from the rivers and the streams and the lakes, to the four-legged beings, the plant medicines, the strawberries and our sustenance, to the stars and the moon and all of creation, Sanguayet Desan, our creator. And that's what we ground ourselves in every day. And I think me doing climate action, me taking action, is also giving thanks, is also living by that Thanksgiving address and making sure that the lands and the waters and our territories know that I share gratitude and I am grateful. And my work is that expression of gratitude. And so this is where I see these intersections take place.
Where do you get this inspiration from and this energy and this boundless, you know, passion that you have to be Haudenosaunee? Were you raised in a traditional cultural way, or how did you, what was your moment for you, Serena?
So my parents were actually homeless Indigenous youth in Toronto. My mom is Haudenosaunee. She's Cougar Wolf Clan. Her dad's Mohawk, my grandpa, so that's where we get a little bit of our spiciness from.
I love a little spice.
Right? I'm like, you probably know how the Mohawks are.
My best friend is Mohawk. Yeah. I absolutely do.
And my dad's Panamanian, so he ended up coming. He's Indigenous to down south. There's always been this strong connection to the territories that my parents have come from. And then I also think it's coming from a family who's been on the front lines. I've had family at Oka. I had family at 06. I have friends and family at 1492. I was at 1492 Lambach Lane. And I think it's just the why I am the way I am is the community that I come from, the people in Six Nations.
Let's look a little to the future in terms of your work. What would you like your community to look like in terms of, you know, climate action in 10, 15 years? What's the best case scenario for Serena?
The best case scenario. This is a major question, because coming from a community of 28,000, I think the first step is that we come together. And I think that's been my whole biggest thing of like, what does a just transition look like for a community of 28,000 members? How can we make sure all our voices on reserve, off reserve, all over the country are collectively understood so that we can create this comprehensive strategy and vision of what we want for our community? So that would be my first goal. So that's just to break down those barriers. I want us all to collectively understand the impacts on our territory, from water to energy to agriculture. And I want us all to collectively create the solutions. And I think this is the biggest part. I want us to implement solutions around clean energy, around water, around food. And I want it to not work in silos. And my whole thing is, I want, in a perfect world, for us to be sovereign and for us to be able to govern the lands and let the lands govern us, and to be able to steward and hold that relationship to our territories in the way that we always used to before colonialism. And so this is all I really want, is us to be healthy. I think that comes down to everything at the end of the day. It's just us to be healthy Haudenosaunee peoples in relationship to our natural territories. And really, that health comes from us being connected, going to ceremony, having our culture, having our corn and our beans and our squash, being able to drink our water, being able to swim in our river, which I never have as a child or an adult now, to be able to really embrace our culture in a way that sustains our health and well-being as Haudenosaunee people. That's really what I envision for us. And I think that's why we're so unhealthy right now, is because we have all of these barriers against. But if we can come together and hopefully break those down and find solutions that will create more accessible opportunities for our people to really embrace being Haudenosaunee, I think that's what will make us healthy. And I think that's what will make the lands and waters healthy.
Serena, thank you so much for your time, your work, and your young elder wisdom.
Oh my goodness, I'm nowhere near that, but thank you.
Serena Montesable is co-chair of Seven Gen's National Indigenous Youth Council. She is Cuga from the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory in Ontario. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Indigenous youth who are climate change warriors. Growing up in Sarnia, also known as Chemical Valley, BZ Gray saw the impacts of climate change firsthand. In 2019, after the Ontario government rolled back its 2030 climate targets, they decided to do something about it. And so they, along with six other youth, took the Ontario government to court. And 5 years later, they're still fighting. Beezy is Two-Spirit and an Anishinaabe land and water protector from Omgenong First Nation in Ontario. Welcome, Beezy.
Hi, nice to see you.
So tell me about where you grew up, the so-called Chemical Valley.
Yeah, I feel like it's really hard to describe, but I definitely try my best. But living next to a bunch of refineries can feel really hard to really fully get people to understand. Like, they put 60% of the highest emitting refineries in the 5 kilometer radius, but we have refineries that span to the 25 kilometer radius of our community. But it's like a really big industrial complex that surrounds our community, and that can look like what's called a flare. So like a big pipe that shoots up into the sky and shoots like fire and flames, or it can look like smokestacks. It can look like big storage drums, pipelines. And we have a place where there's 36 pipelines in the ground in one area. When we describe these things to other people, they don't realize how close it is. When we are literally sharing fence lines with these refineries, like, there's community members that complain about windows shaking because of the equipment that's going off in the nighttime. Like, that's how close is that we can feel like the industries as well.
That might seem really difficult to, you know, wrap your head around that you live in the middle of this industrial complex. What was it like growing up there?
I attended the very first like daycare in Amgenang that was like at the band office. We were right beside an industry, and like it was really weird, but it wasn't weird for me because it was something I seen and like interact with every day, like hearing a siren every Monday at 12:30. And I'm part of the generation where we actually moved the daycare because of health concerns. And we like had hoped that like it would make a less impact on the daycare kids. Kids that are younger than me, they actually have been like as well been evacuated. They have faced a spill and after the fact feeling like sick after. We're still facing like the impacts of these industries, like no matter where you are in the community. There's another story of mine where I was in grade, I think like 6 or 5, and they were teaching us about how clouds were made. And I argued with my teacher because I was like, no, clouds are made in my backyard, because I was so used to seeing smoked snacks. Mm. I thought that was so weird. Like I really had a full blown argument with my teacher where I was like, no, they're not made naturally. And I realized later in life when I grew up, I was like, oh, it's because I thought smokestacks were cloud makers, not because clouds aren't natural.
What were some of those impacts that you mentioned a little bit earlier? What were some of the impacts of living in this chemical valley?
Sometimes it impacts water, like there are spills and there's always worries about pipelines that are going underneath the St. Clair River that are like pre our lifetime have been there for so long. And so there's always worries and thoughts of like the water, and there are spills and things that happen into the water. We've had impacts on our land. So like we're very wary and cautious about intaking any medicines that are grown in our community, but that's not everybody's views or sightings of like we all have diverse understandings or feelings about like those kinds of things. It can look like air spills, so that could be like we had a huge issue of benzene happening in our community for the past few years that we recently got actually some action towards, and that looked like we had to really watch all of our air monitoring systems. And the one downside about watching an air monitoring system is it's letting you know the hour after the exposure has happened. So we were getting really high benzene ratings. It's a category 1 carcinogen. So it's really cancer causing. It's like not really a good safe level for you to be exposed to. But we were seeing really high ones around in our community, and we actually had to do an evacuation this year of some community members in the area. It was a really like interesting thing to see Amgenang put into action, like that this benzene issue needs to be resolved. And we actually did see action this year.
Mm. And what about in terms of the climate? What effect have you seen it make in terms of climate change in your region?
I've definitely seen an impact and feeling that impact when trying to practice cultural teachings, like when I'm trying to do land-based things. But one of the things that I felt really connected to was like reading like old archival notes about my community and doing sugar bushing and like learning teachings about sugar bushing. But in this day and age, it's really interesting of a time to try and practice it because it looks a lot different than even from when our grandparents were doing it at our age because of climate change. Like sugar bushing is a science where you need below freezing temperatures in the night, but above in the day. And so sometimes we can get days where it's like we have a run for maybe 3 days, maybe it's only 1 day. And it's spread out through a longer time period than a month. Whereas in our old teachings, we had something called like a sugar moon, and that would be the moon, the time in March when we would practice sugar bushing. And our ancestors used to see like a really solid run, whereas now it's more sporadic and like hectic.
Mm. So in 2018, you decided that you're going to do something about these harms that you were seeing being done to, you know, to the environment. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was the basis of your court case against the Ontario government?
We are basing it on the impacts that climate change has on our charter rights. We are a youth generation trying to challenge climate targets that are set by a different generation in this government system and how we feel they have neglected to work within the Paris Agreement of reaching climate targets for Ontario. We're not seeing the same numbers that we had seen in the Paris Agreement. They're actually different. And so really wanting to push across that it's like youth are going to be the people that are going to be experiencing this climate in the future that these targets are trying to reach for 2030, which isn't that far away. And we are trying to also have a voice for future youth that we should be able to have a voice in a future of climate change, like that it's not just up to someone like just Doug Ford's government systems that should allow voices of youth who are actually going to be living through this climate change.
Mm. What's the latest update on that, on your case?
We filed for an appeal and we have recently won our appeal. So we're able to go back into the court systems, as I understand, and keep fighting for our original case that we were going for.
What inspired your group to use the courts as a way of action?
I've been doing not just climate, but like also advocacy for my community that started since I was even before in high school, like I was in grade 8. But whenever I would bring up these issues of my community or climate, it would always come up that people would say, like, why don't you fight within a court system? It's a way of holding government, Canada, Ontario, responsible for these things. And as an Indigenous youth, I was like, court systems actually feel really scary for me. Mm-hmm. Like, not my way of, like, my own communities. Like we don't see our natural law actually being held and respected in these courts. Or just Indigenous law in general, like, of our traditional, like, knowledge of, like, governance or our natural law. So that was one of the things that was always daunting to me that actually really interestingly came up in this case when we're talking about seven generations ahead and seven generations back, that like this court case is kind of interjecting Indigenous law with that we are talking about future youth and we're talking about present youth.
Interesting. You mentioned the natural law that many Indigenous nations follow, the seven generations ahead, the seven generations behind. What's important about, you know, fights like this being led by youth?
I think it's really important and interesting because, like, when I think about governance in Indigenous communities, and I'm lucky to be on my youth council in my community, is that in our communities, we do respect and hold youth's opinions and leadership and community like in a high regard. And to have the diversity of my own identity of being Two-Spirit and trying to hold a position within a leadership feels like super important to listen to those young people. And like also at the same time, listening to our elders like that. It's not just like one group of people's voice of like a council or a governance system, that we should also be holding in regard youth's opinions.
Mm. Tell me about the other six youth that are involved. How did you come together with them?
I think it's really interesting because we all came together from different parts of Ontario. Like I'm from the most southern tip, and then we have people out from Thunder Bay, we have someone from like Toronto, and we're all different age groups. So like, I think I'm the oldest out of the case. No, I am the oldest out of the case. And we had some people who started out that were so young that I was so inspired and happy to see. And so I think it's like our different variety of identities that really brought together an interesting like case. And like I only met all of these people through the actual like coming together of the legal case, but like Shelby is someone who we both really connect on like hide tanning, and that was really cool to find like a friend within like this kind of case.
Earlier, you had talked about some of the effects it was having on your cultural practice as Anishinaabe. What happens to, you know, our cultures if climate change continues to degrade in this way?
I think our practices are always going to be resilient. They're definitely, I find, trickier, like learning about them in this climate. And there's also a lot of grief with that, like that I'm not learning in the same ways and like same conditions as like, say, my grandparents, and that I have to do heavy advocation around it in order to protect the climate to be able to use these things. But I think it offers also a really unique teaching that these products are natural based, like that our people have been learning and reusing for years and years and years. Like with hide tanning, it's a sustainable resource for a textile. It's not based out of oil and it doesn't create climate change when you're making it. And it can last for years and years and years. Like we see the hide brain tans within museums, and they're still lasting as visuals for us to see historical past. But like understanding the sustainability our people had with the land is so important to engage with, and also brings a lot of, like, I find, healing and grief work.
And finally, BZ, what are the next steps for the court case?
I'm really excited for the next step of bringing back this court case into the court systems and hopefully getting a win.
Well, we're cheering you on here.
Thank you.
Go, BZ. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this interview.
BZ Gray is a Two-Spirit climate activist and a land and water protector from Umgenong First Nation in Ontario. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Indigenous youth who work to save land and culture through climate action. Jordan Burnoff knows the power of youth firsthand. She's seen their passion and drive everywhere, from the sporting field to the conference room. She herself has been working for a clean energy future since she was a teenager. Now that she's in her early 30s, she considers herself a bit of an elder youth. With her young elder wisdom, she's a mentor to the teens following in her footsteps, including her 13-year-old niece, Evan Flett. Jordan helped create the Sagittawoc Youth Environmental Circle. This group of teens is working on clean energy projects in their community of Sagittawoc, also known as Isle of Cross, Saskatchewan. These projects are all led by the youth themselves. Youth like Evan. Jordan and Evan, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having us, Rosanna. Nice to see you.
Hi.
Let's start with you, Jordan. What was your, you know, your specific moment, your moment that inspired you to want to protect the environment?
I think, you know, I'm looking out the window here and we're in Sagittawoc right now, actually, and I'm in the house that I grew up in. A lot of the time that I spent growing up was spent outside with my kuhkums, my grandmothers or my parents or friends, you know, and it was, I didn't see it until, I guess, recent years, how heavily my life was influenced by spending time outside in nature and learning things out in the bush that I think really drove my passion to want to protect Mother Nature and you know, be a helper.
And when did you first realize that the environment, the climate was changing, that we were, you know, facing some issues in that regard?
Mm-hmm. I think out of high school, I was awarded a scholarship from a uranium mining company, and I worked in a mine for a few summers. And one of the things that really stood out to me was like the sickness in people. There were a lot of cancers that were going around, seeing actual resources or commodities, as they say, being taken out of the earth and then sold, and understanding that whole system and how much actually goes back to communities. seeing the disparity between, you know, what goes out of this country and what people actually make from the land and what goes into communities. And I think that was a big moment, I think, that changed my perspective on the impact that energy can have on communities. And often we kind of disconnect the land from resource extraction, and that was where it kind of clicked for me. But here at home, I think one of the big things, like when I was Evan's age, I'm about 20 years older than Evan now, a little elder youth, I'll say, but a Kukum youth. But when I was her age, I remember we'd like walking through town, you could hear frogs so loud, you know, and they say that when you hear frogs, it's a sign of a good, healthy environment. And we don't hear that anymore unless you're out in the bush somewhere. I remember skunks being under my Kukum's little porch area. So you'd always have to peek outside before you left for home because there would be a skunk out there so you didn't get sprayed. But we don't see those anymore. We don't see that anymore.
And so once you made that connection, you know, the silencing of the frogs, the disappearing of the skunks, and all the illness in your community and connected those dots, what did you then do about it with that knowledge?
I think one of the turning points for me was an interest in solar. So my dad and my brothers are little energy nerds in their own right. And they kind of turned me on the idea of solar. Like we have a lot of cabins just kind of here and there for whether it's commercial fishing, my mushroom's old trapper's cabins, you know, places like that. We're like, off-grid solar would be so interesting, would be such a cool thing to see for some of these, the people that are still out there in the bush and, you know, having to rely on, you know, fueling up gas tanks and taking their big heavy generators everywhere they go just to like sustenance fish or sustenance hunt and to make a living. So that was one of the things that we had explored. And then I started getting interested in energy. And then, you know, as you do, if you follow the money, you can kind of see where the impact really hits, right? And it's like everything that we see in our communities has some connection back to energy, which ultimately means back to the land. And so that was kind of a big turning point for me was seeing, you know, how much we can actually change for the earth if we start to really honor and live in connection with the earth, as opposed to the way that we've just decided to like commodify and own and continue to like push and take over areas.
When did you start to think, oh, I think I need to start an organization?
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of is like a long culmination of things. I had attended a conference called 7Gen that was in McGinsis in Calgary area a few years ago. And that was pretty life-changing. It was a gathering with 200 youth from all across Canada, Indigenous youth, the first of its kind. And it was created by Corey and Disa, who are two youth that had attended a similar conference. It was an international conference for youth and energy. And so I had attended that. I learned so much. I met other young people that were interested in the same things. And, you know, it kind of just catapulted from there. I was involved in a roundtable discussion with about 15 different organizations. There was like Natural Resources Canada, David Suzuki Foundation, like some really big heavy hitters in the environmental space, engaging youth on ways to better involve young people in the energy space. And I just felt that it could have been done in a much different way, I think. There were improvements that were needed. And I think, you know, as we see sometimes with elders being involved in different ways, that's sometimes how youth are being involved. And it's not in a really inclusive way. It's like, let's do the opening and closing, or like, let's get a perspective here and there. But I think with young people, what I found is that, you know, we just need to be there to help guide and to help take away all the tedious, monotonous tasks that kind of come with building up and mobilizing action, and just help people dream and just help people kind of see what the potential is. And that's what I've tried to do here, because that's kind of one of the things that I was gifted from some mentors that I actually met through 7Gen. And then I was chair of 7Gen for a year. We brought a group of 10 youth from across Canada together, and we planned the next iteration of the 7Gen Summit. I co-founded a program called Imagination, where we fund youth groups $40,000 to $50,000 per project on energy and environmental focused projects. And then I started working with the Métis Nation Saskatchewan, and one of the partner organizations, which is the Saskatchewan Environmental Society, they had reached out just from some previous media stuff I'd had done, and they were interested, like, how can we help? How can we work together? And so we came up with the concept of starting this youth circle, because honestly, it's kind of frustrating to spin your tires and try to convince, like, people that just are still so stuck in one way to kind of see a better path forward. And young people just know it. Young people just get it. It is unbiased. It's like not tarnished by all of the economics, by laws, by all of these like concepts or constructs that we make. Like, young people just, they just get it. You know, we think the way to move forward is like innovation, technology, globalization, all of these things. But really what it comes down to is within your own backyard, within your own realm of influence, like, what can you change to do better for that area?
Mm-hmm. Evan, you're 13, which is, you know, very young. I won't even tell you what I was doing at 13. It certainly wasn't leading youth projects like this. It's a very long time ago. Why is this work important to you as Evan?
Because people aren't treating the land as like it's an important thing, and I wanted to change that.
Did you spend a lot of time on the land growing up?
Yeah, I would always go out with Jordan to the cabin.
Remember the first summer, she was so afraid of bugs. That was kind of the starting point. It was like, if you don't come outside, you can't come back to the cabin. So she was outside every day after that. Tough love.
Did you make friends with the bugs?
With spiders, yeah.
Oh, yeah. By the end of the summer, her mom was like, what did you do? Why is she carrying spiders? But tell her about the other things that you've learned. Evan's a little bush woman now.
Oh.
I learned, like, traditions in my family and how to do stuff outside, like birch bark basket making. And I learned how to canoe when I was, like, 8. Yeah, and fish filling.
That's cool. I don't know how to do any of those things. Oh, that's not true. I do know how to fillet a fish. It's been a while, but I can do it. What is the most rewarding part of the work for you so far, Evan? What do you like best out of it?
Yeah, well, like, there's just kids always on their games all the time, and then, like, barely ever go outside.
And what's the impact of going outside? Like, how do you think that changes people or helps people?
For me, it just, like, calms me down.
Yeah.
And it makes me happy.
Hmm.
I think Evan and I have both experienced a little bit of anxiety in our lives. The one solution I had was, like, bring her out to the bush.
Yeah. What is the Sagittawoc Youth Environmental Circle, and what do you do?
The Sagittawoc Youth Environmental Circle is really meant to bring young people together to dream, to dream of a community that they're proud of, that, you know, they see themselves in, that's, like, co-created by them and for them. And I think that's, like, a future where, you know, they're proud of, that they can be able to still interact with nature. They can still interact with the water, with the land, with their language, with their culture in ways that I think sometimes it can be hard to see when you hear all of the realities of climate change. And we just had a massive forest fire go through here a few years ago. You know, those are, we're living through the impacts of climate change right now. And this is one of the ways, you know, one of the little jargon words or the buzzwords of climate change is adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I think Indigenous people and young people have been at the forefront of adaptation. And I think this is one of those ways that we're trying to do that. And so it's through energy literacy, energy education, kind of gaining knowledge so that we can become aware of what's going on around us and what are all of the alternatives, you know, and how does that kind of intersect with our day to day.
Evan, what would you say to people, you know, who are not listening to young people like you when it comes to what you want to do. Like, you want to preserve the land, you want to keep the traditions alive. What would you say to them if you could say anything at all?
Just listen to the youth and, yeah, look at what they're trying to do and focus on that. And then, like, yeah, help them instead of just, like, listening and not doing anything about it.
And Jordan, what about for you? What is your vision and your hope for the group, for this group of young people who are trying to, you know, preserve their lands and their communities and look at different ways of creating energy that's not harmful to the earth?
Yeah, I think we've found inspiration in a few places, and that's like definitely from our own backyard and just looking and seeing ways. Like I live in a little off-grid cabin and chop wood and haul water and don't consume a lot of energy. In fact, our generators are often just going kaput on us, but we're working on solar right now. But it's like looking at things like that, that, you know, often the people who are most connected to the land are the ones that are not as connected to consumption. And I think that's one of the things that we can look at for inspiration is, you know, some of those old bush people that build their own fires and create their own heat and, you know, get outside and spend time in Mother Nature's electricity, which is the sun, right? And we're in a time and place where there's so many opportunities, there's so many jobs, there's so much things that you can get involved in, but there's also a lot of things that don't exist right now that you can create. And that is the beauty of being a young person without having to like see everything that's been created and being like clouded by that, like, okay, it's there, whatever. Like, just come up with a concept and something that you're passionate about, dream it up, create it, whether or not it exists, you know, like find the things that you would like to spend your time on and that you think would impact the world around you. And when you think about impacting young people, and this goes for everyone else outside of the youth category, I think one of the important things for us to remember is that when, you know, we create these spaces for youth to just freely design a world that they want to live in, then the success rates of people picking that up, of young people picking that up and actually doing that is so much greater than if it's a curated kind of concept for something that we think young people will like, right? And quite often what they do create is something that is sustainable, that is very thoughtful, and that is kind of grounded in Mother Nature. I think the way that works for us as Indigenous people from this area is that we are connected to this land, that our teachings and our values come from this land. And, you know, I think that when we get closer to that and we truly understand that and live that, that's how we help lift people out of poverty, out of sadness, out of, you know, a lot of things that really hurt us and harm us.
Well, Jordan and Evan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Rosanna. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Jordan Burnoff is the Sustainable Energy and Sovereignty Specialist for Métis Nation Saskatchewan. She helped create the Sagittawak Youth Environmental Circle. She is Cree and a member of Black Lake First Nation and grew up in the Métis community of Sagittawak, also known as Isle of Cross. Evan Flett is from Sagittawak and a member of the Sagittawak Youth Environmental Circle. And that's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Bridget Stringer Holden, Elena Hudgens Lyle, Rhiannon Johnson, and Kim Kasher. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Gidinaskamit Nawa, Agosay.